for LBW. Oh, he's got him. That's well run, or is it? Oh, well fielded. That's out. That's got to be out. That's beautifully done.
What a great effort. That's unbelievable. That is sensational.
Now, this will be interesting.
Short, fine legs.
Hey, welcome to Short, Fine Legs, South Africa's premium cricket podcast, which is now proudly brought to you by Orcor, Africa's favourite auctioneers. Orcor are the biggest hitters in online and live auctions, featuring the best brands in luxury and budget vehicles and trucks, as well as furniture, appliances and gadgets for your home and office. The Orcor team are also the biggest cricket fans out there, so naturally we're quite big fans of them too. Visit their website, www.orcor.com, or follow them on social media so you're kept up to date with their latest auctions.
Hey, welkom bij Korte Fijne Benen, een cricket podcast die hoopt dit prachtige spel uit te breiden. Hier is je gastheer, Daniel Gallen.
Thank you, Google Translate. And you're right about that. And that's why we've got Bertus de Jong on the show today. He's a Dutch freelance journalist writing primarily for Crickbuzz, but also for Wisden, First Post, and loads of other outlets. He's a bit of an associate cricket expert, but I don't want to let his English accent fool you. He's the man to speak with when it comes to unpacking the game in the Netherlands. And that's exactly what we did with him. So I hope you enjoy. Hi Bertus, thanks for coming on the show. Let's start with the news that the ICC has opted to scrap the ODI Super League. There is a sense of unhappiness from within the Netherlands camp, as no one within the organization was consulted, as per your article on Crickbuzz, which I recommend all our listeners go and read. But before we get into the whys, perhaps you could explain to me, for those who don't know, what the ODI Super League is and why it is significant.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question, because I think a lot of people might have been watching the ODI Super League without even realizing it. But in essence, the ODI Super League is two things. It's a qualification pathway for the 2023 World Cup. And it's also an attempt by the ICC to provide some kind of structure and context for the top end of the ODI format. So while there's been sort of at associates level, there's always been structured 50 over cricket leading to notionally World Cup qualification through the old World Cricket League. That's something that that full members never really had. So the ODI League, in essence, is a 13-team league where it's not quite round robin. Every team plays only eight of their possible opponents, and it's for the full members. So the 12 full members plus the Netherlands, who qualified as the 13th team by winning their final World Cricket League Championship in 2017. Now, for the Dutch, what that meant was that they get eight three-match series against full-member opposition, which is more bilateral ODIs against full members than they've ever had in their considerable history.
Right. So the decision to scrap it is based on what logic? Because from the outside, like you say, you know, a lot of people wouldn't realize that they were watching the Super League, but it seems like a way to combat the perennial gulf between the haves and the have-nots in the game. I mean, what is the ICC's logic in behind this decision?
Well, I'm not convinced that it's the ICC's logic per se. I think the ICC fought very hard and have been trying for probably more than a decade to come up with some sort of structure for ODI cricket, and getting the Super League off the ground was something of an achievement for the ICC because it guarantees some sort of minimum schedule in ODI cricket, not just for the Dutch, but also for smaller, sort of the newer two full members, Afghanistan and Ireland, but also the likes of Zimbabwe and Sri Lanka, who might have struggled for fixtures otherwise. So the ICC, I think, saw this as something of an achievement, but the downside of it from the perspective of larger full members, most notably Cricket Australia, the ECB and the BCCI, is that they, the fixtures that they're obliged to play under that structured league eat into their schedule and basically take up space that they feel could be used for more profitable fixtures, mostly against each other, or to create more space in the calendar for franchise cricket. So the downside of the league from the perspective of the larger four members was essentially that it restricted their freedom of action. And I think what we've seen here, what's happened, is that this is a battle that the ICC has essentially lost. The notional rationale was that a 13-team league as a qualifier, because the World Cup is going to 14 teams from 2027, the notional logic was that there's no sense in having a 13-team team as a qualifying pathway for a 14-team World Cup. But that doesn't really make an awful lot of sense, seeing as it's only the top eight teams from the league at the moment that earn direct qualification to the 2023 World Cup. And even if it were not to be a World Cup pathway, we're reintroducing the Champions Trophy, which is eight teams. So you think there would be sort of a natural logic to then say, well, then why not make a qualifier for the Champions Trophy? Or indeed, like, why not continue running the league regardless? Because now we're going back to rankings, which, I mean, as I don't know how if your listeners have been following how exactly Bangladesh qualified directly for the next T20 World Cup. But I think what we've seen is that the rankings aren't necessarily the best indicator of comparative strength. They're fairly easy to game. It's quite a Byzantine system. And essentially, if you're not getting the fixtures, it's close to impossible to improve your ranking anyway.
Well, exactly. So I guess my follow-up question, before we sort of go further back in time in the history of Dutch cricket, which is mostly why I got you on, which is what I'm excited to talk to you about. But before we leave this aside, where does this leave the associates, and in particular, where does it leave the Netherlands?
Well, I think if we start with the associates, there's seven teams in League Two, which is the tier below the ODI Super League. And they were competing essentially because were they to become champions of League Two, they had a chance of qualifying, either replacing the Dutch or joining them if the Dutch managed to avoid coming 13th in the Super League for the next edition, which means that they could have enjoyed the same benefits that the Netherlands are currently enjoying. So for the remaining seven ODI associates, it's an opportunity that they'll never have. For the Dutch, it's arguably even worse, because while they do have now still a home summer coming with fixtures against England and the West Indies and Pakistan, it looks like that's going to be their last home summer with significant full member fixtures. And there's been, not just in a competitive way in trying to professionalise the squad to prepare for the Super League fixtures, but also organisationally, the KNTB's undergone a fairly significant restructure, setting up an entirely separate commercial arm with the idea that they could be reasonably confident of having a more lucrative fixture list going forward. And that now looks like it's not the case. And it's questionable whether they're ever going to actually recoup their costs.
Yeah. Once again, the ICC, you know, dog being wagged by the three tails of the big boards, if I can butcher that analogy. So let's now go into the murky past. I want to talk to you about the history of cricket in the Netherlands. As is so often the case, the game came to the country by, you know, courtesy of British soldiers in the 19th century, and by the late 1800s, there were clubs competing against each other, and a national team played its first game in 1881. But if you can, what hold did the game have on wider society? I mean, was this a game for the people, or was it the exclusive domain of the elite early on?
I think that's a probably a fair characterization, but it's what people tend to forget is that almost all sports in the late 19th century were essentially elite pursuits. You couldn't really take a look. Most working people at the time didn't have time to play sports. And yeah, the idea is, it's often cited that cricket was brought to the Netherlands during the Napoleonic Wars. And while there probably were some games played, the actual route that it took into the Netherlands was really more to do with cultural influence from England than military excursions. You'll see this actually across Europe, is that a lot of football clubs, some famous football clubs, AC Milan and Genoa famously, began as cricket clubs. And this sort of started, say, in the sort of the middle of the 19th century, when the cultural influence of England over European elites was enormous. Anglomania, I think, is what they called it in the time. So you, in the Netherlands itself, the first game that actually went on to lead to the formation of clubs was played at a school, I think, in what's now Leidschendam, called Noordhee. And one of the people involved with that was Pim Mulier, who is far more famous for having a huge influence on the start of football in the Netherlands. But the two sports actually pretty much grew hand in hand, and that was as a result of that grew out of this sort of elite fascination with all things English, this sort of elite Anglophilia. And the real difference between the two is that while football became sort of a far more demotic sport, that never really happened with cricket, at least over the course of the 20th century, certainly. It was primarily still seen as, sort of a fairly posh sport and a pursuit of sort of rather eccentric Anglophiles.
I understand that the Netherlands' former colonies, most notably Suriname, played a role in cricket's popularity, in impacting the culture of cricket in the country. How did this transpire? Was it seen, indeed, is it still seen as a quote-unquote foreign sport?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's sort of two streams of, or arguably three streams of sort of cricketing influence in the Netherlands, in modern cricket in the Netherlands. One of those is that sort of holdover of sort of private schools and that sort of fascination, that local Anglophilia. And then you did, of course, have from the Caribbean, which also, Suriname and St. Martin and the Antilles, to a greater or lesser degree, also had this sort of English influence, but from sort of moderated through the English culture in the Caribbean. And in the 1970s, you did have a lot of return emigration, which you'll see certain clubs that did begin as sort of Surinamese clubs. But these days, of course, there's a very strong third influence, and that is from the growing Southeast Asian community in the Netherlands. So the cricketing culture in the Netherlands as it is now is sort of it's fairly recent, I think sort of the late 20th century, is a very unusual mix in that regard.
And so the Dutch beat Australia in 1964 by 3 wickets in a one-day game. And if the game was so long established in the region, why didn't it kick on? In such a wealthy country with great industrial potential, I'd have guessed that the raw materials for developing a successful cricket establishment would have been there. You know, access to resources, training, even a small group of elite players could have been well supplied and highly motivated. Why didn't that happen?
Well, I mean, that's a very complicated question, of course, and I couldn't claim to have the expertise to speak to it entirely, but there's certainly a number of factors. But probably the most important one is simply cultural. The clubs that some of the oldest sporting clubs in the Netherlands began as cricket clubs, and several of them still are. But the culture of sport, which it grew out of, was fairly elitist and principally continue to pursue this amateur ideal, which you didn't really see in football so much, or rather the question almost is, how is it that football broke out of that? Historically, there's a number of other factors. People will say that there's a decline of Anglophilia in the Netherlands immediately following the Boer War, but it's not so much that cricket really went into decline as that it more or less sort of continued on what it always was. And that was essentially a recreational pursuit. And if you, even 10 years ago in the Netherlands, you will see that cricket, they were playing one day games in whites with a red ball. And there's a sort of, there's a sort of general feeling that cricket in the Netherlands is almost a sort of time capsule of what cricket was like, maybe 50 years ago. Now that's certainly beginning to change now. Certainly in the last 10 years, at the national level, you're seeing greater professionalisation. The nature of the unpredictability of the financial situation of associate boards means that contracts tend to be a bit on and off and short term. But certainly the general culture in the national setup is a lot more professionalised, and that the KNCB have been trying to sort of change the image of the game in the Netherlands as well. The Dutch top competition in one day cricket has actually only in the last couple of years been playing in colours with white balls. But it's still sort of in a very transitional phase. And it's taken quite a significant blow, if only because that sort of cultural affinity with English culture is still strong in the Netherlands, but not as strong as it was. And the loss, especially of, and this is the one thing that almost anyone will tell you of a certain age in Dutch cricket, is that cricket disappearing from the BBC has been a huge deleterious effect on just cricket in the public consciousness, that you'll see people of sort of my age and older would at least know what the game is and see it as English. And younger people often won't know what cricket is at all, or if they do, they'll see it as subcontinental. And that is a sort of transformation of perceptions, that it's always been seen as foreign in an English way, and now it's being seen to a greater or lesser degree as almost a sport that's played by immigrants and the children of immigrants.
It's such an interesting point that you made. You know, I guess shifting my understanding of cricket, there hasn't been a degeneration. It's almost just plateaued. And I think that's sort of a key takeaway that I'd like the listeners to kind of hold on to. But let's talk about, you touched on the domestic setup. How healthy is it? I mean, it seems to me that it's very localized in Amsterdam and The Hague. Does that tell us anything if we look at Dutch cricket through a social economic lens? I mean, I understand that Rotterdam, whether or not it is, the mythology around Rotterdam is that it's the great working class city. Do they have a cricket team, or is it quite localized?
Well, actually, interestingly, there are in Rotterdam itself. There's a couple of and I mean, there's only 10 teams in the Dutch top division. That's going to 12 next year, but it was 10 up until now. And two of them are Rotterdam clubs. One of them is a very old multi-sport club called VOC that play in the north. And the other is I can imagine you can guess the name, the origin from the name, which is Punjab Cricket Club Rotterdam, based in the south. And then there's two teams actually, one of which has competed for a long time at the top level, no longer does, is one has dropped one league down, and one that continues to, and that's Excelsior and Hermes, both of which are based in Schiedam, just outside of Rotterdam. So I'd say the localization is what in the Netherlands we call the Randstad, which is the conurbation of The Hague, Amsterdam, and Rotterdam. And to a large extent, that's just because that's also just where most people live. Mm.
And how healthy is the setup? I mean, it's perhaps an unfair question to ask, but where would the best team place in English or South African domestic setup? I mean, would they have a chance of competing? Would they get absolutely hammered? I mean, are the teams made up entirely of Dutch people? So, you know, I'm kind of throwing a lot of things at you. This is almost a shotgun approach. But if you could sort of succinctly encapsulate the health of the domestic setup in the Netherlands.
Well, the top division is for I think as a club competition, and cricket in the Netherlands still very much revolves around clubs, the club scene, as do all sports. That's a sort of a facet of Dutch sporting culture. But the top class, as I say, it's only 10 teams, but they are the standards are remarkably high for club cricket, at least in terms of the caliber of the best players is often extremely high. So you'll see usually at least one or two players that'll have first class experience, and they'll do well usually, but not necessarily dominate. But what you will see is that the variation of standards within teams is often quite high because the player pool is low. So you will have sort of an awful lot of teams will always have a couple of kids who are of a far like lower standard than the best players of the league. But if I had to say, I mean, it's you'd say that the best teams with the overseas pros included, you'd be looking at, say, minor county standard.
Okay. How are the players regarded? Are they well supported? Are they professional? What sort of standing with Dutch sporting society do the players hold?
Well, if you'd say Dutch sporting society, then the vast majority of Dutch sporting society is not entirely aware of cricket. So as players from the Dutch national team could walk the streets of Amsterdam or Rotterdam for a month and not be recognised. The level of cricket in the public consciousness is generally very low. And when there is interest, it is generally very localised. But this is also something that kind of is a hangover from the traditions of Dutch cricket, which is that the clubs, that the loyalty is very much to the clubs. And the idea of the Dutch national team, it's sort of seen as traditionally sort of frivolous, because essentially it would only play once or twice a year. I mean, up until, the late 20th century, when the Netherlands became an ICC member and the ICC began to organise structured international cricket, the doings of the national team was far less interest to people than clubs. So you'll see there's essentially no coverage of cricket, or very little, in the national press. But in local, say, local Hay newspapers or local Schiedam newspapers, then the doings of the local club will generally be will be fairly rigorously reported.
Right. Okay. And are they professionals?
No. I mean, certainly the vast majority of, even in top class, it's a pro-am league. So similar to sort of top level club cricket in a lot of countries, you'll have one or two players who are getting paid, and then you'll usually have at least one or maybe two overseas pros who, are essentially professional cricketers. But then, there is at least half of the players, even in a competitive top class of team, are still essentially recreational players.
Are the players essentially contracted to a national board?
So the national team, it's a bit of a curious setup, because there's now a significant number of Dutch players playing county cricket. I think more than there ever has been before. I think we're up to seven or eight. I think it is eight, actually, if you count Stera Kallis, of course, who is now a contracted women's player, and I think the first Dutch woman ever to be contracted in county cricket. So their full-time salaries are essentially paid by their contract, by their counties. And then the Dutch, for the Netherlands-based team, has a contract system, but the only contract that you could really call a full-time salary at the moment is that of Captain Peter Sailor. And then senior contracts will essentially, the costs of maintaining the players are shared between the KNCB and the clubs that they play for here in the Netherlands.
Moving to matters on the field now, obviously the Netherlands are up against South Africa. The fact that there are several South Africans within the setup, Brendan Glover, Rulifana Merva, Colin Ackerman, Stefan Meiberg, I might be forgetting someone, Fred Klaassen, I believe, as well. Does that add an extra element? I mean, is this seen as not a grudge match, but is a three-match series against South Africa, does that carry greater significance? I mean, do you think the fact that there are so many South Africans, does that help increase interest in any way?
Oh, I think definitely for a lot of the players, it's a huge game. Freddie Klaassen's not South African, in fact. Born in the UK and spent a lot of time in New Zealand, and then was here for a season or two before being picked up by Kent. But Clayton Floyd is in the senior squad, and he is of South African origin. Or at least he is, in fact, South African of Dutch origin. But yes, of course, you mentioned those players, and I think several of them are South African born, or are born in South Africa to Dutch parents or the like. Because, of course, there's a huge cultural sort of... There's, of course, long-standing ties between South Africa and the Netherlands. And you will see a lot of South African players in the South African Windsor will be playing in the Netherlands. So we've had several players that doubtless your listeners will know. And Dwayne Pretorius, who's, I think, in the squad, has played a season or two here. But David Wiese, Sebastian Engelbrecht, Stian van Zyl have all been over not too long ago. Heine Kuhn used to play for ACC, I think, again, before moving into county. So there's a lot of, there's definitely a lot of, I guess, friendly rival, you call it. A lot of the guys will know each other. And yeah, a lot of, again, the Dutch, South Africa is often the first choice for winter training camps when the Dutch can organize it. So there's been a huge amount of sort of exchange, not necessarily structured cooperation between Cricket South Africa and the KNCB, but because there's so many personal connections there, that there is really, it's almost like it's almost like a sort of shared world. And there's a lot of, it's almost sort of a revolving door every season of South African guys coming over here and then the Dutch going back when the skies turn grim up here in the north.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is partly why I think it's generating so much interest, you know, with respect to associate nations. And I would, speaking probably for all full member status countries, it's, you know, somewhat seen as a bit of a novelty when you play an associate team. But now there is that connection. On the field, though, you've mentioned how many players play county cricket, improved performance of the national side, you know, rubbing shoulders with the elite, etc. I mean, what are the expectations, both realistic and hopeful?
Well, I think for the Dutch, there's a bit of kind of recalibration of what their ambitions will be now, because while direct qualification to the World Cup, you have to finish top eight in the league, which is hugely ambitious. They've got two wins from three against Ireland so far, but I think still realistically, a top eight finish in this league is always likely to be beyond the Dutch, unless they have an awful lot of luck going their way as well. So their first target was always to stay off the bottom spot, which I think was a realistic target for them. But there is now, with the league being scrapped, kind of a question of what exactly it is that they're playing for. I think looking at this tour specifically, South Africa in South Africa is an enormously tall order. And I think that they would have been happy to sneak one win from three or even just to be competitive. Now, but having then looked at the fact that South Africa are resting an awful lot of first choice players, I think that a few of the guys in the Dutch camp, and you know, they will have played against players of this caliber quite a lot, will be thinking, well, this doesn't look unbeatable. And I think at this point, yeah, they're not, of course, they'll still be basically delighted to win one from three. And I don't think there'll be any reasonable expectations of managing any more than that. But yeah, I think they'll be looking to play competitive cricket. And I think at this point, they'd almost be disappointed to be whitewashed.
And finally, Bertus, before I let you go, South African fans, South African listeners, of which most of our listeners are, we'll be aware of Colin Ackerman and Rulla van der Merwe, as we said before. I mean, who can forget Rulla van der Merwe's reinventing the hoik over third man against Australia? But who are some of the other players that perhaps the Africans, if they want to show off to their buddies in the bar or around the braai, could boast of some sort of insight on players that they might not have known? Who should we keep an eye out for?
Yeah, well, I guess if you're going purely on form, then Max O'Dowd, at the top of the order, has been actually the standout performer for the Dutch in what's been quite a miserable winter. The Dutch are missing, sadly, a couple of players who haven't been, so Logan van Beek and Ben Cooper and Toby Vizier were all sitting the tour out for a number of reasons, and Michael Rippon, of course, is still stranded in New Zealand. But of the squad that you might have heard of, Scott Edwards, the wicketkeeper, has been in pretty impressive form with the bat in the warm-up games. And whether he gets a look in or not, given the competition for seam sections, but Vivian Kingma is, you know, while the Dutch have a kind of, at least an associate level, quite a high reputation for their pace attack, I think of the out-and-out quicks, I don't think that the South African team are going to be as troubled by them as associates batsmen, being as, you know, if you grow up in South Africa, you see a lot of out-and-out pace. Viv King is a bowler, though, that can move it both ways at a moderate pace, but has great control, increasingly impressive at the death as well. So, I mean, those would be my three, though. Given that I'm not the coach, I don't know who's actually looking at this squad. I'm not even sure what the starting 11 is likely to look like. Max O'Dowd and Scott Edwards are the two in form going into the series. And in fact, yeah, Clayton Floyd, if he gets a game, has proved himself to be a pretty dangerous operator with both bat and ball at T10 level anyway. But whether he gets looking in the 50-over squad, I'm not so sure.
Strike early, big runs up top. I mean, South Africans are often troubled by spin. They're not going to be playing on Bunsen burners, but are there any slow bowlers within the Dutch camp that could, for 10 overs, cause some grief?
Well, I mean, Roelof, of course, is well known already. I was quite curious actually at the omission of Flip Boissevain, who's not with the squad, who is seen as the up and coming leg spinner for the Dutch. But I think that I think that Ryan Campbell just doesn't think he's quite ready there yet. So the spinners in the squad are the skipper himself, Peter Saylor, who is, he's kind of struggled with chronic back injuries, but he's an extremely experienced cricketer. He's got some enormous scalps already dangling from his belt if you look back over his career. And he's been actually just quietly incredibly effective left-arm spin for the Dutch. So I'd say the skipper himself is arguably the most dangerous slow bowler inside. Saqib Zulfiqar has been included. He has been preferred over Boissevain. He's also a leg spinner, but more because he gives you more of the bat, especially in a Dutch side with Tendulkar now retired and Cooper and Van Beek absent, that is probably looking a little light on batting. So if we're talking about slow bowling threats, I think the skipper himself.
Excellent. Well, Bertus, I was excited before, but now I'm really looking forward to it. And as you say, it's just a shame that the big question hanging over the series is, well, what is the point of it all? Because, I mean, isn't cricket constantly beguiled by a lack of context? And we thought that we finally had that, but now that seems to be being pulled away. But look, you know, if for nothing else, it's a great opportunity for people to see a new team and to engage with a new set of fans. And yeah, and hopefully it's just good cricket. So thank you so much. Anything you want to plug, freelance journalist, for, as we'll say at the top of the show, Crickbuzz and various others. You got anything that you want our listeners to be aware of?
Oh, I think if your listeners are interested in my occasional outpourings, you're better off following me on Twitter at BDJCricket. Most anything I scribble for anyone will pop along there at some point, as will various incredibly detailed prognostications about the now somewhat less exciting Cricket World Cup Super League. And of course, I do go into some depth about sort of monitoring every team's chances, including South Africa, of course, who aren't really guaranteed necessarily of direct progressing to the World Cup. Certainly not if they drop a game or two this series.
No, absolutely. And Bertus, we appreciate your work and you do so much more, but you're definitely my go-to for all associate cricket. So thank you for the work you do and keep it up, and we'll chat to you soon.
Thanks, Dan. It's been an absolute pleasure.
That's our show. Thanks to our sponsors, Orcore, our producers, POC Podcasts, and to you for sticking with us. Like, share, subscribe. You know what to do. Every little bit helps spread the word, and we appreciate it all. Cheers for now.
Shout for LBW. Oh, he's got him. That's well run. Or is it? Oh, well fielded. That's out. That's got to be out. That's beautifully done.
What a great hit. That's unbelievable. That is sensational. Now, this will be interesting.
Short, fine legs.